Andrea Vicini, in the Society of Jesus, and medical doctor as well, is associate professor of moral theology and bioethics at the Faculty of Theology of Southern Italy in Naples. He's currently appointed as a visiting assistant professor here at BC and was formerly the Gasson Chair at Boston College. And I've just heard the terrific news that he's been appointed starting next fall to be an associate professor of theological ethics at the School of Theology and Ministry. So he'll be joining us permanently, and we're delighted to have his company for more of the years ahead. A practicing pediatrician, he received his medical degree and specialization in pediatrics from the University of Bologna, a bachelor's in theology from the Sainte-Sèvre in Paris, a licentiate in sacred theology from the Western School of Theology, Western Jesuit School of Theology, PhD in theological ethics from here at Boston College, and a second doctorate in sacred theology at the Faculty of Theology of Southern Italy. You need to get some more education under your belt before you talk about any of this stuff. You're really reaching out beyond your training. He has taught in Italy, Albania, Mexico, Chad, France, and in the U.S., of course. A lecturer and member of important associations of moral theologians and bioethicists across the world. His research interests include fundamental moral theology, biotechnologies, reproductive technologies, end-of-life issues, medical ethics, genetics, and environmental issues. We're really delighted to have you here today to talk about this challenging and important topic. And please join me in welcoming Father Vicini.
New image. Thank you very much. I look forward to the conversation that hopefully we'll have after I try to present some data and insights concerning this field. New imaging technology seem to be able to detect degrees of consciousness in a few patients who we thought were in vegetative state. Despite the difficulty of establishing any form of communication with them at the bedside, to reflect on the ethical issues that this new possibility raises, I discuss briefly states of consciousness, the data concerning imaging technologies, and then I try to highlight my ethical approach, focusing on consciousness, identity, and care, and showing how relationality is a further resource in reflecting ethically. The severe disorders of consciousness constitute a public health problem. I look at some of the data. 2 million Americans suffer some form of traumatic brain injury. 373,000 of these people are injured seriously enough to require hospitalization. 90,000 of these people need extended periods of rehabilitation. And 60,000 of people die each year from traumatic brain injury. And another 2,000 are left in permanent unconscious state. And on the website of the Boisy Center, you find an article highlighting data from the U.S. Department of Defense concerning military service members. 202,000 were diagnosed with this traumatic brain injury in the last 10 years. So it is a public health concern. How do we reflect on the patients? How do we have better tools? How can we have better tools to diagnose these patients and identify the state of consciousness in which they are, and then make decisions to help them? And ethically, how do we reflect on this major health issue? The first thing that we need to exclude for our conversation concerns brain death. We are not talking about brain death because there is not the same kind of concern that we need to have in the case of brain death. Brain death is straightforward. Our brain is no longer a mind. When we are dead, no life is possible. And we have, with the technology, the possibility of proving with some criteria that the patient is brain dead. On the contrary, disorders of consciousness are more complicated and challenging. And the first difficulty that we have is in defining consciousness. we lack an agreed definition of consciousness. Neurologists help us to identify an area where there is a complexity. You see that they use three criteria. First, it is the level of consciousness. The patient can be wakeful or non-wakeful. The second criteria is the content of consciousness, so the awareness. The patient can be aware or non-aware. And then the third criteria that we have is behavior, the ability to produce voluntary behavior, mobility or not. And so you see that we go from red, the coma, to green, the patient consciously awake. And you see that we have states in between. So I briefly want to mention this variety of states that we have. Coma, defined in 1966 as the total absence of awareness of self and environment, even when the subject is externally stimulated. It can be a transitory phase, consciousness can be recovered, or the patient can be in vegetative state. Vegetative state, the second one, this one. Surprisingly, there is not a well-accepted definition of vegetative state, despite the fact that the term was introduced in 1963. There is patients are awake and alternate sleep-wake cycles, but they do not show signs of awareness about themselves and their environment. We do not know if they have emotions, if they experience pain, if they suffer, and we don't know if they will recover from that situation, that condition. In the past, we have used a definition that characterized vegetative state as persistent and permanent. And we use to define these two situations, time, causes, to see if the patients were only in a persistent phase or they were in a permanent phase. In 2002, neurologists rejected this definition. And still, the temporal criterion is holding. And again, causes, time, and the causes, time, and I forgot the last one, are considered relevant in assessing their situation. Causes time, the age of the patient, excuse me, and the patient's responses to simulations allow us to assess their situation. And so, looking at the time, the criterion concerning time, 3 months in the case of a non-traumatic cause tells us that we need to wait 3 months to see how the patient will develop. Or, in the case of another type of cause, a trauma, we need to wait at least 1 year to see how things are developing. Then we discovered recently that our brain cells can regenerate. Before, when I studied medicine, we studied that brain cells could not regenerate. And so there is the possibility that with the regeneration of cells, there is a possibility of recovery of brain function. But we do not know how this happened. And so what we can say about vegetative state is very minimal. We can say that it can be a transitional state or can be a permanent state. But we are not able to, at the moment, help the patient to get out of it and to recover the ability that concerns consciousness. Third possibility, minimally conscious state, in between. It was defined in 2002, and the definition is a condition of severely altered consciousness in which minimal but definite behavioral evidence of self or environmental awareness is demonstrated. So the patient responds to simple commands. It can give us a yes or no with the gesture to what we are asking the patient. He can, in some cases, have intelligible speech or purposeful behavior. Or, in some cases, we don't have any of that. But we, as I will show now, have probably the possibility of having a technology that will help us to assess the possibility of a minimally conscious state. So in this case, what we could think as the ethical approach of a vegetative state, so the reflection, the discernment, the decision-making process concerning withholding and withdrawing life support, doesn't apply, because we need to be more accurate in ascertain the degree of consciousness of these patients and hopefully help them to recover. The last possibility that we have, it concerns the so-called locked-in syndrome. As a consequence of a traumatic or non-traumatic injury. As the term suggests, we are locked in, so we have not the ability of communicating to the outside world that we are fully conscious and aware of what's happening. Two cases, one in the US, Julia Tavolaro, in 1966, she was 32 years old, she suffered two strokes, she was hospitalized in New York. After 6 years, they discovered that she was trying to laugh at the joke that was said in the room. And then they developed a more accurate assessment of the situation. They discovered that she could move an eyelid and she could use it to say yes and no. At the point that she became able to move her head, use a motorized wheelchair, use a computer, write poems, publish a book. You see the book here. A similar case in 1995, the editor-in-chief of the fashion magazine, French fashion magazine Elle, Jean-Dominique Bobby, suffered a stroke in 1995. Similar story. He published a book too, the speech therapist helped him with the eyelid, left eyelid, to interact with speech. He published a book. He died of pneumonia 2 days after the book was published. And there is a movie also on his story. So in these patients, we see that they are wakeful, aware of themselves and of their environment, but they have very limited ability of any other type of voluntary behavior. So how do we discriminate among these situations, and how can we help these patients? How can we explore more brain activity and discover how it works? One technology that was suggested is functional magnetic resonance imaging. The technology works in terms of detecting blood flow in the brain in response to a stimulation. An image, a sound, the voice. And we recognize changes in breath in the flow in the brain, in the healthy brain, in the locked-in, the minimally state conscious state of consciousness, and in vegetative state. And you see the difference in terms of response of the brain to stimulation in these different situations. Why do we need a better assessment? Because we have a very high percentage of misdiagnosis in this complex area of disorders of consciousness, 40%. One case is an American in the US from Arkansas, Terry Wallace. He suffered a car accident at the age of 19 after almost 20 years in what was considered vegetative state. In his case, too, they recognized that he had the ability of interacting. The family had tried to explain, to tell the nurses and the staff in the nursing home that he seemed to react to what was happening. They didn't believe that. And finally, in 2003, he recovered consciousness in a more visible way. And unexpectedly, he could remember things from the past. So he said his social security number, just one of the first things that he did. And also he could use his memory, remembering new things, so new song that he could hear in the radio. Recently, in 2010, in an article published on the New England Journal of Medicine, a group of researchers from Cambridge in the UK and Liège in Belgium studied 54 patients who were in these two areas, vegetative state and minimally conscious state. They wanted to see if their patients were responding using an MRI to a stimulation. And they wanted to see if the patients could communicate. So if we could use the response to the stimulation to get a yes and no from a patient who could not communicate with us. They, to test their motor imagery, they proposed, asked to the patient to imagine standing still on a tennis court and to swing an arm to hit the ball back and forth to an imagined instructor. And then to test the spatial imagery, they ask the patients to imagine navigating the streets of a familiar city or to imagine walking from room to room in your home and to visualize all that you would see if you were there. So, and then comparing with the controls, they saw that, they noticed the same type of responses. So they wanted to confirm that in those 54 patients, they could prove that there were or there were not responses to these three tasks, motor imagery, spatial imagery, and communication. What were the results of the study? Only 5 patients willfully modulated their brain activity. And only in 3 of them, they checked further and they discovered there were some signs of response at the bedside. And they tested only 1 patient about communication, and the patient answered to autobiographical questions in the right way only to 5 questions. They discussed why not the 6th one, that there is plenty of hypotheses. Other studies were done in a similar way on using visual images, sounds, words, even the name. What are the implications of these studies? I think that is extremely interesting in terms of their evaluation of the results before saying why they wanted to do that. They did not dismiss negative findings. So they affirmed that you cannot dismiss negative findings with these technologies. Now, the problem that we have, what about false positives? Do we have that problem? And I will show that in a moment. First, why do they want to explore that? Because they would like to use a type of technology to get an answer from the patient concerning the therapy of the patient. So they want to open it, they call it a new era in terms of treatments concerning these patients. Mm-hmm. Now, false positives. Do we have a technology that allows us to avoid false positives? 2009, at the brain mapping conference in San Francisco, a group of researchers presented data concerning 3.8 pounds, 18 inches dead Atlantic salmon. And they had placed the salmon in the MRI, and they showed a series of photographs to the salmon. And they asked the salmon to respond in terms of emotional behavior. But what is surprised, you are laughing, it seems a joke, but they noticed a response. So there was a positive response in the dead salmon to this kind of testing that you do in a person in a minimally conscious state. Why did we have this false positive? Because the problem in fMRI concerns the corrective systems that are able to filter the random noise in acquiring the sequence of images. So there is a problem in technology itself that causes us to be critically suspicious, to have a hermeneutical suspicion concerning the false negatives and the false positives. So ultimately, is it reliable? Can we use this technology or not? As an ethicist, I say, well, we always said that technology is not sufficient, that we need always to integrate the technological criterion with the other criteria that concern the better care, the better treatment that we provide to the patients. In this case, we need to, as ethicists, integrate what technology can tell us about consciousness with our own reflection on consciousness. and then on identity, and then on the decision that we need to take concerning the care. So I propose that we, as we do in the ethical tradition, continue to reflect on consciousness not in merely as a technological, not with the need of a technological assessment, but in relational terms. Always understanding consciousness in the context of relationship that a person develops, on the interactions, not merely as scientific data that we need to gather. Secondly, I would say that, already I mentioned about even about identity, we should not limit ourselves to an assessment of identity that is merely technological. Of course, having greater clarity concerning the situations, the degrees, the levels of consciousness can help us to preserve and recuperate consciousness, but it's not sufficient to rely on the technological criterion. A relational understanding of our identity highlights situations in which our identity depends on others and the decisions that others need to make on our behalf. And also it allows us to understand that even the fact of losing our identity or partial loss of identity can be integrated in our reflection on our own identity, on the loss of my identity with my when my brain is injured. So identity is, from an ethical point of view, a multi-layered concept. It is embodied, it is historically situated, it is shaped by events, by social dynamics, and by the context where we live. And by integrating the technological criterion concerning our own identity with a relational way of reflecting our identity, we can understand it better, and hopefully we can preserve it in a better way. And we can continue to shape it and enrich it. So, the ethical tradition invites us to continue to discern, even in what concerns identity. Finally, care. This understanding of... I checked, if you want, to confirm the importance of the relational criteria. I look at what the official Catholic teaching affirms about end of life. And while the Catechism gives us, and the Declaration of Resignation 1980, gives us four criteria, John Paul II adds a relational criterion. So invites us to reflect on the decisions that concern the end of life in light of not only what the patient wants, as the Catechism does, but also in light of the context in which the person is situated. Finally, care, as again another insight that I think we can stress further. And care implies, of course, being cared and caring. And care shows, it seems to me well, how we are part of a relational dynamic in which we receive care and we give care. In the case of these situations for these patients, care, of course, needs to be competent and targeted to the patient and her needs, both at home and in rehabilitation centers. But this care is under stress. First, because of the uncertainty in terms of diagnosis. Secondly, because, and so the need in terms of care is to keep the patients, the options of the patients as open as possible. And so find the ways in which we can help the patient when we recover the ability of making decisions to have a large spectrum of possibilities, avoiding consequences that are related to the period, for example, in coma or before recovering consciousness. The second cause of stress is time. When patients are in rehabilitation centers, they're under time constraints because the centers need to get results in 1 month's time. And, of course, these patients need more time to begin to recover some of the abilities. When there are moments in which the patients have plateaued, and so they need to different settings where they can receive the care that can help them to advance. The third cause of stress is the place. Usually, rehabilitation centers give to these patients a very limited time to for the care that they need. And the two other options are nursing homes or the family's home. And nursing homes are not the best place to receive the rehabilitation that you need. And family needs to be helped and supported to care for the patients, and also need to have the means to help these patients. Finally, autonomy seems to me is under stress too. And I mean the autonomy of the caregiver, of the patient, of the family members. But all of them are challenged and threatened. And so we need to find ways to rethink our own autonomy. And it seems to me that a relational understanding of the autonomy of each moral agent could be helpful. Concretely, it means to consider our own best interests as they relate to the best interests of others. The alternative is, hence, a virtuous relational understanding of autonomy, in which we react to a more narrower understanding, more individualistic understanding of autonomy. And finally, we need to pay attention to the context in which we reflect on consciousness, identity, and care, and of the dynamics that take place in this context. So we need to continue to think about the healthcare system, about the priorities in the healthcare system in allocating limited resources. Finally, to conclude, imaging in disorders of consciousness could help us to assess these patients more carefully by distinguishing them. First, we might have patients who are in a vegetative state, or for whom the extensive brain damage does not show any possibility of recovering their consciousness. So the ethical decision concern, it seems to me, the discernment that we need to make about how to let them die, withholding and withdrawing would surface as discerning options. Second, fMRI might allow us to identify patients whom are in a transitional vegetative state, or in a minimally conscious state, or in a locked-in syndrome, and could help us to develop more ways to stimulate their recovery. These patients need a better rehabilitation, a longer rehabilitation that goes beyond the short-term acute care. And their families need concrete support in caring for them during this long period. Third, fMRI can create more problems to us, particularly when we'll discover that there are only a few neurons that are working, not areas as we now identify. But what are we going to do when we discover that there are only a few neurons that are firing? So I think we should begin to discuss what we think is appropriate in terms of technological criterion to give us indications about our own consciousness. The fourth final reflection that I have, as I said before, we need to continue to question our healthcare system and the care that it provides, and to reflect on the changes that are needed to promote the greater justice. And finally, we need also to highlight the virtues that could strengthen our ethical commitment and our just relationships. Professor Martone, a mother, professor of theological ethics, has gone through this ordeal in her own family with her daughter, a young college student, University of Chicago, car accident, coma, vegetative state, and then gradual recovery. But again, everything that I mentioned as part of her story, and now that the daughter has spent years at home, helped at home to continue rehabilitation, and she's recovering as what could not be expected, at the level that was could not be expected in the past. She invites us to reflect on the virtues that should guide us in reflecting on these issues. And as you see, she suggests to find ways in which our decisions allow us to be present, to wait, to guard, and to love. Thank you.